Hi, I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Dr. G.
And this is the first episode of the first season of Kung Fu Friday, a show that explores the best of Asian action cinema and hopes to inspire you to discover some awesome flicks from the other side of the world. KFF is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. But first, let's remind the folks at home about our credentials as Kung Fu film fans. Dr. G, where did you start?
Well, actually, I remember watching on our local affiliate, cable affiliate, we had a USA Network, and they had a Kung Fu theater on, I think, like on Saturdays. And I just loved those movies. After that, I would say later in college, I got really into Kung Fu and the martial arts through a combination of studying them and then really getting into like Asian cinema and wuxia, and then also just from role-playing games as well. And I think also I got into, for a while there, Chinese comics. Like I used to love Force of the Buddha's Palm. Or the Bloodsword Dynasty series. I thought those were both really awesome. So that's kind of my Kung Fu and Asian cinema bona fides and where that sort of genesis. And it's just leads to here today.
It does at that. For me, it's much later in life. Of course, I'd seen great wuxia epics like Crouching Tiger, which is very recent, really. It's, so mostly through the 2000s. And then we started a movie night here at home some years back. Every week we watched an Asian film. Usually an action Asian film. So a lot of Shaw Brothers, a lot of Golden Harvest, a lot of Media Asia distributed stuff. lots of Hong Kong stuff and other countries. And we really built up a culture of it. And Kung Fu Friday is actually what the movie night was called. So we've since elapsed and it's still a movie night, but we watch musicals and, older films or discover indie films, all sorts of stuff. And sometimes we go back to Asia, but we did that for like a good almost 5 years. I had to use it eventually for a podcast. So here we are.
It was all training. It was like the tedious menial task you had to do at the Shaolin Temple, which you later discover made your Kung Fu very strong.
Ah, well put, because that's all going to pay off during this show, people. Each episode will explore a basic theme. It might be an era, a director, a particular action star, a country, a style, anything really. And we'll pick two films to showcase that theme. So our double feature this week is Shaw Brothers Studios, which like the big original movie studio that brought Kung Fu to North American screens. We've each picked a movie from that studio's massive output. It would be true to say that over the years, this is a company that produced some like 1,000 films, not just Kung Fu, but 1,000 films, basically through the late 60s and early 80s, many iconic titles. It started as a film production company, in Hong Kong, founded all the way back in 1925 by three Shaw brothers, Run G, Run Me, and Run D Shaw, mostly for film distribution originally, but the business was taken over by Run Me Shaw and the youngest brother, Run Run Shaw, who, with his wife, Mona Fong, can be seen in the credits of all the classic films of Shaw's golden age. The iconic Shaw Brothers brand actually started in 1958, and then it ended around 1987, really. The company suspended film production in order to concentrate on the television industry through its subsidiary, TVB, which they still produce a lot of kung fu for television. You can tell when you're looking at a Shaw Brothers movie, can't you? It looks like a Star Trek episode.
Oh, yeah. No, it has...
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And although I think, to be fair, they had a range of how good the quality and how low the quality. And I would like to say that their output is positively Bollywood in its density of movies that come out. Something that not most people know, but the Bollywood industry is like, oh yeah, Hollywood, you're nice. Here's the 20 times more movies we generated in a year.
Right.
In that same year. So
you can tell it's got, it's like a, like, it's not Technicolor, but it's got this really vibrant color scheme. And it really, the way it worked, for them was this was a job, like, everyone at the studio, and like the studios were based somewhere in the territories, not in the city of Hong Kong. And they had these standing sets that people would use all the time. And so you've got a lot of outdoor scenes that are basically indoor scenes, like courtyards or whatever, with painted skies. so they could work at night. Basically, you were on shifts, even actors were. And it was just like a big production line from top to bottom. People writing, people directing, acting. And you might have a part in this movie and then have a shift where you would go, you know, be in a fight scene in this other movie. And you're just doing the work. You're just there all the time. Yeah. And so you recognize these courtyards, these temples, these, you know, these tea houses. And they also had like these bigger outside sets, like there's a town. There's basically a, you know, a studio lot town. You know, when they're in nature, it's very often the same kind of the dirt crossroads with the mountains in the back and the ocean. Yeah. You see that in a lot of the movies and they just redress them, you know.
So is that the Chinese version of Vasquez Rocks?
It definitely is. And, you know, when we watch these movies every week, you know, you get to recognize the landscape and you know it's always exactly the same places. It's all the time, all the time. The little bridge from One-Armed Swordsman, it's in everything. So yeah. Like the fake forest, it's always the same places and they sort of redress them somewhat. But basically those sets are there and my movie needs a set and the fight's going to take place there. So we go there and everything is scheduled so that maybe I'm using the town and it's supposed to be a certain era. So you can't. And, you know, so they're making these movies at a fast, fast rate. Highly choreographed action scenes that take a long time to film. So essentially, the cheaper productions don't want to spend too much time outside where sunlight is a factor. You know, there's definitely a look to these things. It's called Shawscope. That's how it's advertised, Shawscope. You can tell it's Shawscope because when the camera moves from like pans, it's sort of like there's a bubble effect. Everything's kind of fisheyed.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Yeah. It's so funny you should say that because they kind of do blend together. And I'd always kind of gotten this, but, you know, there's to compare to sort of Bollywood movies in this case, it's very funny. I always find that those movies have this, what would be the kung fu fights usually are a dance and music number instead. Mm-hmm. Although they have their fights as well. And the fights you'll see on them are, these guys are, might as well be kung fu fighters. So when we had this, we were like, oh, let's do Shaw movies. I was thinking of like movies I wanted to do. I was like, is that a Shaw movie? And then after a while, it was just like, it's probably better to ask, like, is that not a Shaw movie? It was most likely a Shaw movie if it was from like, you know, 58 to like 80 something.
Basically, their only competitor through the 70s and 80s were Golden Harvest. And Golden Harvest had a more what they called an indie style where, you know, they don't have the money to build a big studio. So they're shooting guerrilla style, lot more outside stuff. And they basically banked on big names. That was Golden Harvest's deal. So they had Bruce Lee until his untimely death. And then they got back on the horse with newer stars, comedy stars, Sammo Hung, obviously Jackie Chan. So when you see those people in movies, they are not Shaw Brothers. Shaw Brothers had their own stable that we also recognize. And today, Shaw's is still a thing. Here in Canada, Shaw Media basically owns most of the cable market.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And Rami Shaw and Mona Fung is still alive. And he died only like 3 or 4 years ago. So these are people in their 90s and still running that Shaw empire that started way back in the 1920s, if you can imagine.
That's
Chinese medicine.
I think it's just Chinese grit and tenacity. They've definitely embraced the idea of dynasty, you know, a long-running dynasty there.
When your names are Run Run, Run Me, Run.
I know. I'd forgotten that like they had those names. I was like,
so what movie have you chosen from Shaw Brothers catalog, Doc?
I've chosen the film The One-Armed Swordsman.
Hmm.
How about you?
I chose 1978's 36 Chamber of Shaolin, a true classic of the genre and considered one of the high marks of the Shaw Brothers kung fu films.
Tells us that in the great infinity beyond all the nothings is the emptiness of the eternal five. The five flavors dull all the taste.
The five tones deafen every ear.
The five colors, they all blind the eye.
Teacher, I came to learn to fight, but this...
So 36 Chamber of Shaolin, it is by, and all through this, we're probably going to have problems with pronouncing Chinese names, but the director is Lau Kar-Lung, my favorite Shaw Brothers director, if not my favorite, you know, Chinese director, full stop. In the film, he's credited as Liu Chai Lang, which is the Mandarin version of the names. I like the Cantonese version, whatever. Bear with me. So Lau Kar-Lung, responsible for a lot of comedy films later on, but 36 Chamber isn't quite comedy. And it stars Gordon Liu as San Tae, who people will know as Pai Mei in Kill Bill. So he was still active much later. In fact, he was active in films until he had a stroke in the early 2010s. And he was Director Lau's adopted brother. It's kind of that kind of Chinese adoption where they had the same master, and so they considered themselves brothers. So Lau Kar-Lung gave him his first break. He was then in a lot of Lau Kar-Lung films. We also have Lo Li as the villain, General Tien, who is best known as King Boxer, the Five Fingers of Death, the guy with the iron hands. A rare heroic role for him. He usually played villains. So in this, he does.
Yeah, no, he's got like the mustache of a heavy. In this movie.
But when he shaves it, babyface can play a hero. I don't know why he didn't play more, especially with the success of King Boxer in the States. But, you know, maybe that didn't translate back in China. Now, this movie has other titles, and all these movies have other titles, because when they came to America, they gave them more badass names, I guess. That would be what was happening there. Because the alternate title is Shaolin Master Killer, which is ridiculous because he never kills anyone, nor would he, is basically the strange conceit.
Being a Buddhist.
Right, a Buddhist monk.
Yeah, in fact, actually, yeah, we'll get into a little bit about that.
I mean, they usually have these more vicious names for the American releases. 36 Chamber of Shaolin is the actual translation of the Chinese title. It is available fairly easily. There's a great DVD and or Blu-ray package from Dragon Dynasty, which is the Weinstein Brothers' distribution company for these Hong Kong classics. You can also rent it on YouTube, but it's the English dub, which I think is atrocious. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, I watched it on Amazon Prime, and so you can also, and it was the English dub and I didn't have the option. And so I felt bad because I could tell like I was missing so much, but I think it was also in the spirit of Kung Fu Theater. Horrible dub.
With 36 Chamber, I checked out both, you know, since I do own the DVD.
Oh.
I had that option. And yeah, you do miss a lot with the English dub. We'll talk about that. Now, here's a short synopsis so that people who haven't seen the film know what happens in the film. So very briefly, when a young student escapes the injustice of the conquering Tartars, he finds his way to Shaolin Temple, where, over years, he's allowed to become a monk, baptized San Tae, who happens to be a historical figure. He trains in martial arts and eventually gets to be overseer of one of the 35 training chambers. A more veteran monk requires him to defeat him in battle before he can do so, which leads San Tae to create the three-section staff, a weapon the other monk has no practice defeating. However, he wants to found a 36th chamber where laymen could be trained and use that training to defend the Canton territory from invaders. He's exiled for having this thought, as Shaolin Temple does not concern itself with worldly affairs. Regardless, he starts to recruit men, and with their help, defeats the Tartars, leading to the actual creation of a 36th chamber of Shaolin. That's the plot in a nutshell. I'll ask you first, what did you think of this? Had you seen it before?
This was actually my first viewing of it. So I have to retract some of my kung fu bona fides. It was everything that the classic kung fu trope were, and specifically the Shaolin trope, you know, of going to the Shaolin temple and going through their like esoteric and rigorous physical training and spiritual training to, you know, come out as the sort of ultimate badass fighters. I have a very soft spot in my heart for the fictional version of Shaolin, or the epic myth all the way back from the David Carradine kung fu itself, and then just being just ridiculously into. I feel I had my, in my 20s is when I had my like Bruce Lee martial arts phase. So I really got into it. But yeah, I loved it. It was great. It was amazing physicality in the martial arts of it. But also, I think the story was, you know, that whole training, just the training, the bulk of the movie, which is him really training up to his power set, as it were, was copied. And you see that's what, you know, everybody does in every other movie of that genre afterwards. So yeah, it's very much the trendsetter of that genre.
It's striking how not like other Lau Kar-Leung films it is, because it's obviously it's not a comedy. He does a sequel to this called Return to the 36th Chamber, which is a complete send-up of this whole idea, which basically the same story beats, but played for laughs. And, you know, it's not like the training isn't humorous. There's a lot of weird contraptions in there, strange things that must do. So it's not funny, but it's not an actual comedy, especially with those bookends, which I almost resent them being there. You know, all the stuff with the Tartars and it's extremely violent, which is something that most Lau Kar-Leung's films were not. They weren't bloody, tragic things. They were about, and this one still is, they are about martial arts themselves. They were about the philosophy of martial arts. They were about the styles and all the weapons, and he uses as many styles and weapons as he can in each film and really showcases them and showcases the interior element of martial arts. So you always see Gordon Liu in this thinking, realizing, you know, how to defeat how to solve the puzzles put before him, how this will actually enhance, or how he can enhance his own kung fu using these lessons. And you see him thinking and looking and realizing things. And when he creates the three-section staff, which is one of my favorite weapons, by the way, you know, it's done MacGyver style. It's, you know, an accident happens. He sees like broken bamboo and he goes, And the next thing you know, he's created this new weapon, which is the only way he can defeat an opponent who is trained up in everything, basically, who uses butterfly knives, who aren't really not the best of weapons, to great effect. And so it takes the three-section staff, which can entangle, and it can strike and entangle. It's got length, but it can also be used close quarters. And it's really, you imagine that somebody using this, just like nunchucks, can hurt themselves badly.
Yeah.
But Gordon Liu is so good.
It's like a bendable pike that is either one part of Screama Sticks and one part almost like a whip. So
yeah, it's amazing. So Lau Kar-Leung brings us, and this is something that you don't get as much in the English dub, you know, the Zen Buddhist lessons that come with this and what it means to martial arts are about discipline. And it's not just about, you know, learning skills. There's an interiorness to it. There's a philosophy to it that the character must come to as well. And by the end, even though he went to Shaolin Temple wanting basically the skills to take revenge on the people that hurt his family and friends, that's not what he ends up doing. Not really. Yes, but no. You know, it's about liberating his people at that point, but he refuses to kill and he sees.
Yeah. So I watched the English dub and I did get a lot of that. I felt a lot. I think one of the things is, I think it best represented in the 35th chamber sequence at the very beginning. And I felt there was so much of like the kind of the built in of the Buddhist parable there. Or at the very least, so this is sort of once again, the more like the cinematic, you know, mystic version of Buddhism. But that sequence and the way it was shot and specifically the way the sound is done in that sequence was, I think, phenomenal. Some of the most phenomenal sequences in the movie itself. But yeah, no, you can definitely see that. And then throughout his training, one of my favorite stories, and this is the kind of story like that you read, like I said, when I was in my 20s, I really kind of got into like martial arts and the philosophy of it and then the history of it as well. So I did a lot of reading on the topic. And you know, one of the stories that you come across a great deal is the nature of the story is always the same. It's someone's at the Shaolin Temple and they have spent like, you know, years or a year or something doing this like one laborious task that seems to do nothing. And they themselves are completely disheartened because they're like, this is a fool's errand. I'm just having to do this thing over and over again, and it's not kung fu. And then, you know, some occurrence happens where they use that ability and they realize, oh no, I really have built the kung fu. We see this in the story I'm thinking of particularly is one where the Shaolin monk tells the student to, you know, he has to go to a well and get water out of the well and fill a cistern with it, with water, and then slap all of the water out and then go back to the well and do it again and do it every day. And he does it for a year. He goes home back to his village and everyone's, you know, wants to see all the kung fu he's learned and everything. And he gets so frustrated because he's trying to tell them that he's not learned anything. Like there's nothing there. And then he slams his hand down on the table and cracks the table in half with the hand that he's been using to slap the water out, and realizes that that was the kung fu training. And you see it again and again. I think for Western audience, especially of the 80s, it's the wax on, wax off sequence from Karate Kid.
Exactly.
He's convinced that this old Japanese guy is like sold him a bum's bill of sale, you know, because all he's had him do is basically paint his fence and do all these menial tasks over and over again until his arms hurt. And yet when Mr. Miyagi then attacks him, he sees that he immediately has the built-in muscle memory and instincts to block those specific attacks, and has that dawning realization. And I work in education. It's that aha moment from a student-teacher moment that if you're a teacher, you live for. So every time I see it in a kung fu movie or a martial arts movie, it's like one of my favorite parts, because it's like I know that feeling on the other side as a teacher having a pupil and giving them a task that they didn't realize what it meant, and then when they really get it and they're just like, oh my gosh, I totally get it now. And that's one of the great things. And that whole middle sequence throughout the movie of him going through the different chambers of training as he trains his way up in the Shaolin way is exactly that over and over again, which is, I think, one of the really strong points in the heart of the 36 chambers. So actually, I do have a take on the movie that was kind of weird.
Okay.
So this was my first time watching it, and you know, I went into it, you know, with my normal, like, okay, I'm ready for all the good kung fu beats, you know, training montages and esoteric lessons if there is, and this sort of like watching your guy get beat up like crazy at the beginning and then being a super badass at the end, you know, all of that structure, the superhero origin story basically. But then I kind of watched it in a second way in my mind, of not focusing on the kung fu aspect of it, but the actual, like, the plot going on in the background. And this is going to be, I feel, not a lot of people are going to like this take I have it, but there's this weird moment when I was watching, I was like, am I watching someone be radicalized into a religious cult? Well, due to civil unrest, because there's like an invading government, basically, that's brutalizing the people. He was an activist student who then, you know, like his family and everyone, his friends are either killed or he has to flee, nearly dies getting to the Shaolin Temple, where he has that unbelievably gnarly looking, like, gangrenous leg wound, and then goes through this, like, very, what in some instances I would call, like, torture form of training. I mean, that whole, the light sequence with his eye training and his reflex training, it's this amazing sequence, but there's also this serious, like, you know, this is the kind of thing you do when you induct someone into a cult, you know, like you deprive them of sleep, put them in like physical trying situations, and then, you know, here's some flashing lights to do hypnosis, or the burning incense. I was reminded of the story of the Hashishin, where we get the word assassin from, where they would go through a sort of like a vision quest and consume like a massive amount of like hashish as part of their initiation into that. When I looked at it from that point of view, I'm like, huh, this is an interesting lens to look at it. But then I remembered, no, this is a kung fu movie, and I just want to watch him like break boards and smash people up with his fist. So, which he did. So I was very happy.
Well, it is a religion. I mean, it is a cult in that sense. And he's supposed to stay inside the temple, right? They're not supposed to be using their kung fu on the outside. But that's an interesting thing when they exile him. Is that punishment, or is that giving him the freedom to go out and do the thing that he wants to do without being a member of the temple, so that they can keep their oath and yet free the country from the oppressors? So it's like a way to having their cake and eating it too. That could be interpreted that way, where because the monks are so, they're really very impressed with Sante. They're, I mean, he's the guy that came in and had, just with his determination, sort of whipped everyone's asses. I mean, he went up the ladder much faster than anyone else. Even the other monks are going, whoa, isn't he going a bit, isn't this a bit soon for him to give, to get to be an overseer? And they want to put him through more challenges so that he proves his worth. And he does every time. I mean, his motivation is not to become an abbot. His motivation is to go back out in the world, you know, and fix the problem. And you see it from the beginning, because even though he's ambitious in that sense, he gets caught helping other students with their challenges, you know, when they're running up with the water, and it just shows, I mean, even greater feats of strength. And you have to imagine that even though there are special effects possible, you know, like empty buckets or whatever, a lot of this stuff Gordon Liu is doing for real. I mean, he's really putting himself through things. And the physicality of these things is what brings us back to Kung Fu cinema, really, because there's so much physical prowess to it. Lau Kar Lung, one of the things, one of the staples of his films that I, you know, I love to watch them just because the fight choreography, of course, is always good in these things. But his, he lets the camera roll for more moves than any other director. Before the camera cuts away to another angle, you will see 8 to 16 moves from the principals on screen. You know, sometimes I just play around with just counting them. I just look at the film and then the fight starts and I start counting until the camera cuts. And, you know, it gets up there. It easily gets to 12 to 14 very often, 16 occasionally, and 8 is like a minimum. And for the actors, that means going through all these moves consecutively without missing a beat, sometimes with more than one opponent. Always, always very exciting to me, that whole just letting the techniques tell the story.
What was your, of the chambers of training that he went through, what was your favorite? Because one of the things I love about cinematic kung fu is that there's a heavy, almost like, I would say, like quasi-mystical ability level to it. It's a little beyond human capacity. And there's some sequences where you see him build into that and the way it goes. And
well, there's that, the weird jumping over, you know, jumping on those wooden sticks in the water. There's a lot of cool stuff there, I think. But somehow, I think the one that most sticks out in my mind is the wrist chamber, where he's holding this wacky, I mean, it's a very strange hammer on a perch, and it's very hard to lift up, and you're supposed to keep the beat and ring the bell so that it doesn't disrupt the meditation of the monks who are meditating to this bell. And you actually see there's like a lineup of initiates where if somebody fails, you got the rest.
All with like bruised wrists that look like they're about to break or have broken and they're just still working on them. Because, you know, it's not just that it's hitting it, because every time they hit that bell, that reverberates right back down through their arm as well. So it's, you know, if you've ever hit a gong really hard, you know, it makes that nice sound, and then you realize, oh, my bones are ringing too.
What's interesting about it too is that, like many of these tasks, there are things that you have to do in the temple and that don't have anything to do with fighting. And later you realize that was important. And you think, well, okay, he's just, you know, he's going to have strong wrists, just like he's building up strength. That's fine. But I like the moment where it's revealed. All the things he does, he uses later in when he's exiled. But that bit is where he grabs a spear and gains leverage on the spear because he's got, you know, a powerful grip and wrist action. You know, and that's the moment where you didn't think you'd get a payoff for that one kind of thing. And you do. So I think that may be my favorite bit, although I love all the ones with contraptions, you know, like just the eye training and where he's just slapping on these dummies with the mirrors shining through them and all these weird things that, you know, somehow there's all this danger room stuff inside Shaolin Temple. That stuff is fun too.
Well, I mean, that's the legend of it. Although the bell sequence is probably the one closest, probably the most accurate one, that they would do these tasks. Although, see, that's interesting because one of the things I got out of the bell sequence was the lesson wasn't about like just making sure his body was strong enough to handle it, which is clearly what some of those lessons were. Like that water bucket one was by far the most like, yes, this is just to build up your upper body strength, you know, and your endurance most than anything. But one of the things I felt was like, and you could see it in the abbot who was at the time like leading the chant and the drumming, was when Sante starts to continually change his stance throughout and keep changing the position of his arm. It was kind of almost like I felt the lesson was far more, yes, he built up his arm strength trying to do this one repetitive action, but the real lesson was to like be fluid. Every time he hit it and he changed positions, he didn't really give it the sort of like the reverberation from the bell back through the mallet or anything time to really kind of negatively affect his body. It was sort of almost like he could now do it endlessly, which is in most like martial arts lore is the kind of thing of like when you have like that, the perfect breathing and the perfect mind body synergy in what you do, you can do seemingly heavy like respiratory and aerobic activity and still, you know, and breathe normally and never have your heart rate elevate. So I kind of saw that as it. And also it's like he's doing this training in this like incessant gonging tonal sound. It also has this almost like mystical like mind sounds sort of synergy, almost like it's magically training him and changing him in a way too. So it's a great sequence. And I think like with, like I said, with the section with the 35th chamber, for as much of a visual medium it is, those were places where I think the sound really does all the work of the sequence. Because once he starts getting into hearing him off the beat, the whole sequence and the bell sequence, and then when you hear his strikes come into beat with them, you really sense that it's like, now he's found the Tao of what he's doing there, the natural way of the Buddha through it.
I've got one final question. It has to do with the finale. Because all these films, all Shaw Brothers films, end on a freeze frame. And in this case, it ends on two freeze frames, or it ends twice, because there's a freeze frame where you actually see the reveal that there is a 36th chamber and that he succeeded in convincing Shaolin Temple to do this. Great. The final fight with the villain, which ends on a headbutt, you know, mid-flight headbutt, and it freeze frames. And then, boom, we're at Shaolin Temple. There's no real closure in that moment. You know, no defeated body, no what came later. We just skip ahead. How did you feel about that kind of ending?
You know, it has to be one of my problems I have with actually a number of movies from this genre. Because I've noticed that happens a lot, not just in Shaw Brothers, but in other ones where I can't tell if they're just leaving it open for a sequel. You had this really big movie and definitely like a boss battle at the end, but then it just kind of ends abruptly, as if, you know, you almost were at the end of a TV show and not that's going to have like another episode next week rather than the end of a, you know, a movie. And 36 Chamber is pretty, I'd say, a fairly epic in its sort of, at least in its sort of martial arts scope of what it goes for.
In this case, I mean, it always happens, but in this case, I sort of made a connection between what happens in the duel with the other monk, with the super proficient monk played by Hoi Sang-li. And it's that when a fight, you know, they decide when the fight is over. There's nobody's lost necessarily. There's no one on the ground, but someone admits defeat. They just say, well, your kung fu is better than mine. And we cut out of the action, not just in that time, but we often cut out of the action. And we presume that Sente won. But I wonder if that's all part of the same thing. You know, at that point, it's useless to show the end of the fight. He's already won. You can see that he's already won. You know, when the guy is on the ropes, well, that's it. He's done. And you don't need to see the kill shot. And in this case, it prevents the film from showing Sente possibly shedding blood, which would be against his own principles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know what, you know, what happens after this. You defeat the big bad guy and you can't kill him. Do the villains just run away? I mean, that's not part of the film. That's not important to the film. And in fact, I think the film would have worked without all these bookends and we'd just been at Shaolin Temple almost. It takes a half hour just to get there. Having seen it before, that's the stuff I wanted to see again. And, you know, I felt resentful that we didn't see it as quickly as I wanted to.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point, because if the movie had ended with him like being banished from the temple and having to like leave the temple and wander the world, I mean, that would have been the perfect like place to do a pickup for a sequel, which could have covered that whole like, okay, I've now left the Shaolin Temple where I lived this very like esoteric life of, you know, focused reading of sutras and carrying up buckets of water and, you know, and learning kung fu, to having to come back to what, you know, like I said, if you strip away the sort of like the patina of B campiness that like all kung fu movies of that era seem to always get, and you take it as a straight film, you know, he's coming back to a fair amount of, like, political intrigue, where he is, as he later finds out, you know, if his identity is discovered, is a wanted person in his own land. So that itself is, like, a whole other movie that could happen. And it, you know, it has a really, like, sort of really fast wrap up at the end, because I kind of had that sense, like, okay, he's coming back and he's going to do this big fight and he's going to win, and he does, but you really get the sense that, like, him doing that wasn't really what was important anymore. And it was, in fact, when, you know, he all gets his revenge not on the main guy, but on his sort of second in command, the really bad second in command guy that really kind of harried Sante the most, you know, it's not him that kills him, and you can tell he's very regretful when that man dies. So it's a very interesting, and I don't feel they necessarily stuck the landing on that. I see their intent, but I don't think they stuck the landing. But yeah, I think I would have rather seen more about what was going on in the Shaolin Temple. I would have loved another 35th chamber sequence. That sequence was so badass. I almost wonder if it's like, well, they have to, you know, these bad guys have to pay for it, what they did, to kind of, like, square the karma of the internally of the movie. But by the time he leaves, that's not really his thing anymore.
Well, regardless, it is an iconic film, an influential film. It's the ultimate training movie and training sequence. You know, it's like the longest training sequence in any kung fu film, probably. We'll take a short break to train up, and we'll be back with the One-Armed Swordsman.
Greetings, listeners. I am Dr. G, the man of nerdology. I host the Pulp to Pixel podcasts. I and my rogues gallery of co-hosts explore the media multiverse of geek culture with such shows as Welcome to Astro City and Secret Sagas of the Multiverse. Now I am proud to announce the newest addition to the Pulp to Pixel podcasts, Dial G for Gamer, a superhero gaming podcast. Dial G for Gamer will be a semi-monthly show where I and my co-hosts play and review games with a superhero theme. From tabletop games to video games, we will take on the genre one superhero game at a time. So if you love superheroes and gaming as much as we do, then tune in to Dial G for Gamer. You can find episodes of Dial G for Gamer with the other Pulp to Pixel podcasts through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. You can follow us on Facebook at the Pulp to Pixel Podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Pulp to Pixel, where I go under the name Dr. G Nerdologist. And you can find episodes directly at our blog, pulptopixel.blogspot.com.
Man, you come right out of a comic book.
The Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, exploring the media multiverse of geek culture.
He meddled in things and should leave the local.
Unless I'm much mistaken, that means you must be one of the students from the famous school of Chi.
But you only have one arm, though. That must make life a little difficult. Now, we don't want to be unreasonable. So if you'll just hand over that fine golden sword to us, and then bow to each of us in turn, we might let you go. If you won't, then we'll take it from you.
Next time, I'll really hurt you.
We're back. Dr. G, your selection, a 1967 classic, one of the very early Shaw Brothers classics, The One-Armed Swordsman.
Yes, this movie, once again, 1967, is part of, I guess what you would say, the subgenre of wuxia. So it's basically a swordsman epic. And was directed by Cheng Che, who had Wang Yu or Jimmy Wang Yu as the titular Feng Kang, who is the one-armed swordsman of the film. It doesn't really have any other titles. It goes straight by that. So not as confusing as some kung fu movies can be with its multiple titles.
That's true. In English, at least, because the French version has a pretty colorful title, Un seul bras les tue à tous, which translates as Just One Armed Killed Them All, is the French title.
Ah, okay.
So it's much bloodier.
It's still available. You can get it on Dragon Dynasty DVD and Blu-ray. I saw it personally through Amazon Video. It was part of Prime, but you can also order it. It looked like it was like $1.99. The only problem with the Prime version is it was a dubbed version. And while I like the dubbing for the sort of kitsch factor in kung fu movies, this was a movie that as I was watching it, I was like, I really wish I had seen it in the original language. Like, I felt in the original language, it would not have felt as cheesy. I liked the cheesiness of it, but like, I also would have loved it more if without. But anyway, I digress.
Right. When it's more of a heroic, romantic, the wuxia stuff, it's more off than normal.
Yeah. So let me just go quickly over the synopsis of the story and we'll get into it, huh? Briefly, the one-armed swordsman revolves around Feng Kang, the son of Feng Chang, who is a disciple of Master Qi of the Golden Sword School. And when Feng Kang is a child, his dad is killed defending Master Qi, and he is then becomes the ward of the master. And over the years, his most dedicated and talented pupil in the sword. Years later, when he's kind of in his teens or sort of young adulthood, he gets challenged by other members of the school, essentially I would say a high school brawl of sorts, and is maimed and loses his right arm. He is nursed back to health by Xiaoman, who finds him, and he develops a deep relationship with her, but also has to struggle with the fact that he is crippled and one-armed. He eventually, though, does learn special sword techniques and becomes a masterful left-handed one-armed swordsman with his father's broken sword as his signature weapon. This is perfect timing because as his skills are rising, they are tested as a rival to the Golden Sword School is plotting against them and is slowly picking off the members with a special technique learned just for that school. Ultimately, Feng Kang is able to stop the first student of Master Qi from killing the master and sealing his position as the undefeatable one-armed swordsman. And so that's the basics of the plot. And we'll get into a little more of that next.
You know, this is, I said it was like an early Shaw Brothers. Of course, Shaw Brothers started in the 50s, but this is like really the start of that kind of Shaw Brothers films that we recognize them for. I mean, it's a slick production. I think it looks beautiful with all the snow and the early scenes where he gets his arm chopped off. You know, it's got powerful music. Of course, it's stolen from other soundtracks. That's what Shaw Brothers did. But it was, at this point, this is Chen Cheh would become one of the most prolific of the Shaw Brothers directors. And this is his first big hit, really. And it spawned a lot of other one-armed films and a lot of other wuxia in that style.
Yeah, no, I loved the color palette of it. I felt, especially with it being in 67, I really felt that the color palette, like, perfectly hit the same sort of color palette of the original Batman 66 series. And I felt like, at least in the dub version, that some of the dialogue and some of the acting was like of a piece of that era. Cause when it got a little like overly soap operatic, it still like through the whole movie, I was just captivated with the plot. I think it went really well. I liked some of the sword work, especially the whole attention to like special techniques. That's something that was probably one of my favorite parts of the sort of genre conventions that we saw in this movie.
You mean like the move and counter move, and everybody's trying to develop the move that's going to beat the other move?
Yeah.
So like in this one, there's like those golden swords. And so the villain, you know, has like this sword lock made, and they're able to grab the sword and then use their other hand to stab someone in the gut because it's a Chang Cheh film and Chang Cheh loves gut wounds. This is actually pretty demure for him as far as gut wounds go. Later on, it gets a lot bloodier.
Yeah. Well, I think also, too, this is, as I was doing research on it while watching it, this kind of hits into that like anti-hero character. In Feng Kang, we really have a character who's like, you know, he's definitely like honorable and noble, but, you know, also carries this sort of like chip on his, no pun intended, but chip on his shoulder. And just definitely like, I was in one of the readings, I said that they likened to the idea that his crippling is also like kind of metaphor to sort of young adult or teen alienation that you sometimes feel. And you could see a lot of that, like, especially in that, those opening sequences with the other schoolmates, you know, that was very much the sort of like very talented but quiet student who, you know, kind of keeps his head down while the other more popular or at least flashier students sort of, you know, kind of like look down on him or are in some ways jealous of him, I think, in that case, in this case specifically, I should say. But yeah, no, I mean, there was a lot of like that whole opening sequence. I was like, this is high school drama. This is like real, like high school drama. And I was, I liked it too. I was like, this works. It really worked. So yeah, no, there's definitely a different tenor than say what we saw, I would say, in the previous movie we discussed.
It's much more of a drama, and you evoked Batman. This is a sort of a Batman character. His father is killed. It's a Spider-Man, maybe, you know, the teenage gets bullied.
Oh, no. Daredevil.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Daredevil.
Yeah. Like highly skilled physically, but also like crippled.
Obviously, it's a coincidence. This mostly was poached from the Wuxia novels that were popular at the time and still are in China. So some of these characters are, you know, versions, or sometimes the names are the same as in the novels, which aren't readily available to us Western readers. So, of course, we see superhero drama in there. It's that lens. And there's a thing with Jimmy Wang Yu, who he's not much of an actor. Let's say. He's very stone-faced, which adds to that grim character that sort of became his trademark later on. Because what did you think of, for example, there's a romantic triangle in here, sort of, between him and then there's the daughter of his master, mm-hmm. who is kind of a jerk. And she's the one that cuts off his arm in a crazy play fighting accident. And then there's the peasant girl who finds him, who nurses him back to health, and who he marries. But do we ever feel that one arm, let's call him that one arm ever likes his master's daughter? Because she claims he does, and he rebuffs her, but we never see him looking at her in that way. So it seems like there is no romance there on his side. And yet maybe it was scripted to be there, and it's the actor who doesn't play it. I don't know. What did you think of those moments?
I really didn't feel he liked her. I think it was far more she liked him. And just with the character, I mean, the daughter of the master was the worst. She was, I mean, putting aside just the fact that she cut off his arm because he was, and he literally said, I won't fight you with swords because I don't want a mistake to happen. And she was like, oh, you don't think you can win? He's like, you tell yourself what you want to feel. And he, sure enough, he was 100% right, because as soon as he like showed her even a little bit that he was way better than her, she chopped off his arm. he was a bit stony faced for sure, but I kind of liked it, you know, because he had, this movie is clearly, and especially the series of it is clearly of a piece of like a Django or any other sort of like serialized gunfighter, or the series I'm going to liken this the most to, which it made me think of like the whole time through, was the Zatoichi films. So I don't really think he liked her. And even the one he marries, he loves her in the sense that she saved his life and he feels like obligation and duty to her. But, you know, he loves very much more like the mastery of the sword more. Now, I'd have to see the rest of the series, though. I've only seen this one. So if they develop that more, but I kind of felt that like he loved her, but they seemed fairly to have a fairly chaste love. It was a little hard to tell. You know, I didn't feel they had the sort of physicality chemistry that would really sort of show it. And I think he explains it. There's a sequence with the master's daughter where he saves her life and she's basically like, why'd you do this? I cut off your arm. And he's like, let me just be clear. I don't like you. And that was before you cut off my arm. But, you know, I feel this greater and bigger obligation. And no matter what, like, I can't call myself a man of honor if I don't do this thing, which I 100%. That got me in the, like, righteous guy heart, you know, sort of.
It's like he's doing it not so much for her, but because his master's honor is at stake. if his daughter, because they even say it, if his daughter is assaulted, he'll never be able to, you know, he'll lose face.
Yeah.
And so he's almost not doing it for her because she doesn't deserve it. She doesn't deserve his mercy after what she did. And that's like a very violent sequence with he cuts off other people's hands.
Yeah.
It's almost ridiculous. They're still holding the knives.
Those two guys totally were asking for it. They were A-plus jerks throughout the early part of the movie. So I did not feel bad one whit for them. You know, and it's funny, too. There's a lot of superhero element in him, too. Getting back to this idea of, like, you know, likening to Daredevil, where there's a whole set of sequences, including the rescue that we were talking about, where he wears a mask throughout it. And when I was watching that, I was like, this hits kind of a lot of like really great tropes that are, I can only describe as this is where I live sort of tropes. And I really dug that. I really dug that a lot.
I mean, the whole, you know, chaste romance thing is really a Chan Che trademark. All his films use the women almost as obstacles. They get in between the brotherly love of whatever heroes. So here, the peasant girl who he marries is really like the most fully realized romance I've seen in a Chang Che film. Sometimes it gets homoerotic even. Not so much in this, but yeah, it can get there. It's just a measure of the style and what he's interested in. But he never really makes any sexual chemistry between men and women spark up in his films.
It does not matter, as long as it's good. Which this movie definitely was. I was really taken by it, because I really feel the, once again, like, it's the swordsman epic of it. And, you know, it had, like, so many good beats of, I could see this as a really good, like, Western. You know, you could recast this as a Western, like the one-armed gunman or something like that. And it would work. I mean, you could make a spaghetti version of this. If there probably is already existing one. I mean, Django, I guess, because he always gets his hands, like, destroyed at the end of each movie. So that could be the case. But, you know, though, although with their relationship, it's funny how you described how it was, like, the most fully realized relationship. And I think about the relationship between the peasant girl who saves him and one-armed. And it had that sort of, like, duty complexity around built into it that I would say, you know, another director like Wong Kar-wai would find like very fertile ground to work with or something like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, that's, we're talking about one of my favorite directors, but very, very elliptical. A very different kind of style. And this was, I mean, yeah. This captured the imagination when it was, you know, first came out. And it spawned many one-armed boxer and one-armed swordsman flicks. So you could easily imagine more modern version, a Western version. That makes a lot of sense. And poor Jimmy Yu Wang, who just became so typecast in this. I guess he spent the better part of his career with his arm tied behind his back. Like, just here's a list of films in which he has only one arm. You've got, of course, this one. Then there was Return of the One-Armed Swordsman. Then Zatoichi meets the One-Armed Swordsman. So a crossover with Japan. A One-Armed Boxer, the One-Armed Swordsman, One-Armed Swordsman Against Nine Killers, and he's a one-armed boxer in Master of the Flying Guillotine. One of its alternate titles is One-Armed Boxer 2. So there you go. So he spent a lot of time doing that, but he wasn't the only actor to be in one-armed movies either. Cheng Chia would go on to make Crippled Avengers, which was like all the characters had a different crippling. It was basically Five Deadly Venoms, except everyone had a different handicap, including a Daredevil figure who was blind. So,
nice.
You see? So it all connects. It all connects.
The One-Armed Swordsman Against the Nine Killers, on Amazon, the tagline for it is, he'll show them that one arm is better than 18. And I was like, yes, I will be watching that next. It went on my queue, like, immediately. I'm like, yes, please. More of that.
Completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
One of the things I really did enjoy about the film was the theme of it, because we have a one-armed swordsman, so obviously he's missing an arm. He uses his father's broken sword, and that is the key, both those things. His strange style that no one is accustomed to, fighting with only one arm and using a very shortened blade. You know, the sword lock doesn't work against that. It's too close quarters for the move that the villains have developed. So it's about not just overcoming, but using your supposed weakness as a strength. All the characters have something missing in their lives, kind of thing. So you've got the peasant girl he marries is a woman without a past, because her parents died without her knowing even her last name. And that seems all very relevant at the time that her father was also in the martial world and a bodyguard to a master. And you think, well, that's all going to come back at some point. It doesn't. Maybe in return, I don't remember. But it doesn't really return. It's just her father died, you know, working for a master in this martial world. And so she doesn't want One Arm to be in that world anymore because, you know, her own life was destroyed by it. But it's how, you know, he gets the book that tells him what moves to use to recover. And, you know, she gets it from her dad. And even that book is crippled. That book has been burned and destroyed. And there's only one half left. And it happens to be the half he needs. There's no moves for the arm that's missing. So all of those themes that come back, and he's been excised from, you know, the master's group, and that makes that group weaker until he comes back. So it's always about what's absent in each of their lives. So I like how the theme is worked into it.
Yeah, and one of the things I liked a lot of what you hit is that it's there's so much of it that like smacks of myth and has a mythic quality to it. The crippled warrior with his father's broken sword through a, what I'll, and for all intents and purposes, is a magic book, you know, learns secrets of the world and then is able to kind of come back all like badass to fight the villains and stuff. And, you know, so the whole like student returning to kill the master, that's Vader and Obi-Wan right there. And yet, you know, this other character has to come in. And it's just, there was so much of it that it was like, yeah, it doesn't always hit a movie like this or an action movie or any movie that uses this sort of like, kind of builds in this very epic structure to it. You know, it can't always hit. You got to mix it just right. And this movie, I really felt how it hit that. You know, I loved the 36 Chambers, but there's something about this movie, like I felt of a piece a lot differently about it. And I had a lot more, I'd have to say, affection for it too. Even though I loved the 36 Chambers, this one I was just like in it all the way. It's kind of hard to describe, but except for, you know, it was awesome. I loved it.
It's more staid. You know, it's quieter. There are fewer action scenes. You know, you can live in those moments, and it's actually fairly emotional for one of these films. You know, there's more drama to it. And I think that's part of the fact that it was an early film and they didn't have that formula yet. And by the time we get to 36 Chamber, more than 10 years later, there's a formula to it. There's a certain level of action that's expected. And in this case, there were no expectations. And you get, I think, a lot of the more dynamic stuff in the film comes from Cheng Che's use of a handheld camera. He was apparently the first to use it in Hong Kong cinema, or so he claimed. So we'll believe it. And so you know, it's still very dynamic and fresh. And I think he's always kept that edge across all of his films, regardless of even when it became very, very, very action-based. You know, this is more romantic-based. It feels more like Crouching Tiger, which is, you know, an eventual descendant of this film.
Oh, in fact, actually, I thought about that immediately when he gets basically the manual for left-handed swordsmanship. It reminded me very much of the plot elements of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where, was it Silver Fox? The older woman who was kind of like after Chow Yun-Fett's character. And she had the manual, but they said like she couldn't read it. She didn't have the ability to read it, so she could only work off the pictures. And so her like technique was incomplete and things like that. So back to the idea of like martial arts techniques and this idea of like the special counter move. This was something I really enjoyed a lot in this movie because that's one of those things I feel is kind of a very central trope to kung fu movies. They're in some ways very much like sports movies because there's always like a training up montage of some sort. You got to see that character get better, you know? And that's where the sort of, sometimes I would almost say quasi-mysticism of kung fu movies comes in. But this one I particularly enjoyed. I love the idea how the sort of the evil master discusses how like there's like 65 distinct sword strokes and they're all like right-handed. And so the special sword they've developed, a technique with the grasper at the end, which it's funny because it was basically a modified hook sword, which has usually a curved end on it, which if you've ever seen someone use hook swords is just amazing, especially when they do they'll usually use them at twos and they'll hook the hooks on the end and they can actually whip the sword like a flail And it has that same sort of crescent moon bladed guard. So obviously it would be a horrible thing to be hit with. But I loved that like sort of like special weapon. And I like that like second dagger attack that they use, that sort of dagger sneak attack. I really appreciated that. This movie had me thinking a lot of role-playing games as well. Specifically how there was a lot of like signature weapons, or someone had like a favored set of weapons. There's that gang after he cuts off the hands of the two henchmen to Smiling Tiger, basically hires this gang of like, I can only call rugby hooligans because they all wore the same uniform. but I love that because they were this sort of like team of all uniformed guys, but they all had like a different like signature weapon. And that's in that tavern brawl. That tavern fight was, as someone who's like, you know, loves Zatoichi movies, that's a classic. I felt like a samurai movie moment as well. Once again, got me where I lives. But I love this idea of like the special technique. And then he has, because he's a left-handed swordsman, it's the one thing they didn't prepare because they just prepared. This is the problem with over-specialization in your field. You never know when you have to have a little more diverse sets of skills. And this was exactly that case. What did you think of that, like, aspect of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a classic trope, and you see it all the time. What I especially liked in this was that it featured the two people responsible for all that diversity. I'll explain. Because the villain, the demon with the long reach, the top villain, who uses, like, those spears and the whip, he had two henchmen. One was dressed in blue, one in, like, beige,
yes.
I remember. The one dressed in blue is Lau Kar-Lung, the director of 36 Chamber, who did the choreography. This is very early in his career, and he did the choreography for this film, and he stars in it. In the choreography, he even gives himself a pretty good death moment, because he looks at the camera, more or less, looks in our direction when he gets killed mm-hmm. by the one-armed swordsman. So he gave himself a little moment. So he's in charge of all the moves and practicing those moves and how that it'll work, and Chang Che used him in his early films to choreograph action, and eventually that led to him becoming a director in his own right. So that's the link between our two films. The other henchman is, I've misplaced the name here, but he's the weapons maker at Shaw Brothers. So he's the guy who made those sword locks and who made all those various weapons that were, you know, specialty ones, the ones that look different, like the golden swords and the... So some of this stuff is traditional historical weapons, but mm-hmm. some of it is fanciful. And when it's fanciful, it's that guy who made it. When you see him in the film, the first time you see the two henchmen, he's the one who explains the sword lock. So he's basically the cue to the villain's James Bond. And he gets to explain the weapon that he crafted, that, you know, he designed for these sequences. So it's interesting that, you know, that everyone was involved intimately. What you see on film is actually what was happening in behind the scenes as well.
Nice, nice. Yeah, no, it's always good to see that too, because it's... And I think that's one of the good things about the Hong Kong movie studios, specifically in this genre, is that, you know, the choreographers were often directors who were often actors. So, you know, it was just as likely they would be in the film doing, you know, doing bits and doing scenes and even doing fight scenes if necessary. You know, if Jackie Chan's taught us anything, they'll totally let their actors and directors get hurt and still keep filming.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's actually pretty awesome that it was there. And especially that they were basically the mini bosses before the final boss battle. So that mm-hmm. was pretty awesome as well. I loved the effect of them not showing his face throughout. The only thing that was the sad about that payoff was that it didn't end up being like someone I knew. Like, I don't remember that character from, or at least I missed it if he appeared earlier in the story. You know, like, there was the one thing at the end. I was like, oh, so that's who he is. I'm like, I don't know who that is. So either it was supposed to be an actor that, you know, may have been known to Hong Kong audiences that I'm not aware of. Or I loved that bit of not showing his face. But then when they did, I was like, I wish there had been a little more payoff of he was someone who's been there, you know, even possibly even secretly guiding one-armed. And one-armed is like, discover that, oh, no, we have, you know, this... You know, there's this big betrayal at the end. But as is, it still worked out pretty well. And I loved the fact that he had such a diverse, exotic set of weapons. You know, the set of spears, short spears he carried, and the whip, and the dagger, and the left-handed hook, and, like, capture sword. Once again, he looked like a really cool D&D adventurer. with a whole set of like more weapons than you should probably carry one time. I can carry 20 swords, right? I can carry 20 swords. That's not overly heavy, right? No, no, not a problem.
I think the effect was only to make him sinister, mm-hmm. because there is no reveal there. He was always going to be the rival school's master. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's something about a face people would recognize, or, yeah. You know, it works as a malevolent presence throughout the film. And it's only when they show his face that it might have stayed demonic or, you know, dangerous if we'd never seen it.
I think that plays a lot to, once again, Vader as this sort of, like, you see him, but, I mean, in that first movie, it's a lot of subtlety with what he does. I mean, except for his, like, big fight with Obi-Wan, a lot of his action is very simple actions. I mean, you know, we don't see him doing big sweeping things like we see in, like, the end of Rogue One. He was very much like, I felt like throughout, specifically that first movie, that very like faceless, implacable, but you were just kind of scared, knew to be terrified of him, and or at least respect the danger of his power. And I felt that was definitely the case with the long arm, which another thing I love is like the crazy names that they sometimes get in Wuxia. Long arm demon. Yeah, that's totally what people will go around starting to call themselves. You know, I guess if you're a badass like him, I guess you can get away with it.
Well, all these films have, you know, the hero's journey at the center of it. And at the end, one-armed swordsman gets offered the role of schoolmaster. I mean, he could have become the master of that school because his master was retiring. And he rejects the martial world at the end, which is almost a surprise, and goes back to live as a farmer/fisherman until the return of the one-armed swordsman, where they pull him back in.
Yeah, which I like that. I love that because I knew, I mean, knowing that there was going to be sequels, but even at the end of this movie, had I not known there were sequels to this movie, you just did not see him giving up that sword. Like when he makes his pledge, he's like, I promise not to use it in anger, but he's also like, but I'm going to use it if like we're in danger or you're, you know, you or me or someone we love is in danger. I will totally use it. So, you know, I'm not going full pacifist, but I will definitely not avoid using it as much as possible. And, you know, didn't keep that promise at all very, very long.
Well, he sort of did because he had to finish it. This whole squabble between the masters, they would have kept coming after him because he was a former student and they were killing off all the students. So, and I think he pays his debt basically for having been raised by this man after his own father was killed by the forces of this evil master. It's all, I mean, there's revenge in there, but it's about paying that debt. And once the debt is paid, dropping the sword and saying, I'm done.
Oh, we know that. And honestly, at the end of it, it was like, you're kind of too good of a character to let that happen. So we'll kick you when you're down a few times, and then you can come back with your sword. It'll be perfect. We'll make tons of money.
That's true. He did return. So we've come to a feature we call Best Moves, where each of us has chosen the best move from each film, and we're going head-to-head until only one of them stands as the move of the week. The move of the strong, really. So in 36 Chamber, what was your favorite move of the whole thing?
My favorite move is definitely the training bell sequence. It's basically when he gets the rhythm and he figures out how to do it, because inherently he learned the lesson to be like sort of constantly moving and constantly sort of changing his position, because that was the key. Like if he stood in one place and tried to like do that one repetitive motion, it injured him. It injured all of the students who were testing at that level. But you notice as soon as he figures out that all he has to do is keep changing his position as it's sort of like to favor him, to all the best parts of his body as he's doing it, that's my favorite move, because it was that dawning sort of martial awareness that comes with, that borders on that sense of like enlightenment as well. That part where like martial arts becomes part philosophy and sort of almost like mysticism. And I like that part sequence a lot.
Well, it's a pretty intellectual choice. Mine is, I went really nitty gritty. I went like a small moment, and it's in one of the fights when he is exiled from the temple. And I call it the lantern strike, where he grabs They've all got these lanterns on sticks, and he grabs them and then swings them around as a makeshift weapon. And they strike at that, and of course they blow up. The fire just like, and so they get a flash of fire in their faces, which, you know, destabilizes them. That's like, I thought it was like a really clever little moment. I kind of feel bad not to pick a three-section staff move, but that was just like such an intricate choreography. I can't pick out one move.
Yeah, like that whole sequence in general, yeah.
So if we debate it quickly, which move do you think is actually the best?
The lantern move. As a straight up think on your feet move, I would say the lantern move that you described is way better. The bell move I described, I feel, is like, this is the foundation you build all your other cool moves off of, sort of thing, which is why I liked it. But it's seeing it in application, which makes it super cool. And so, yeah, I'd give you that one on the lantern move.
I was almost going to give you the bell move, if only because it better represents the film. You know, the film is about the training, and the film is about the inner life of martial arts. But I'll take the win. Okay, so in One-Armed Swordsman, now I'll start here. My favorite moment, my favorite move, is the payoff to the broken sword. So when they actually try to snap up his sword, and it, since because it's broken, it doesn't work, and he sort of, you know, that whole move where he's holding the sword way up high, mm-hmm. after slashing someone kind of diagonally, and then he stabs someone in the gut. I mean, he actually uses their move against them. What about you?
For me, it's actually the bad guy's move. I loved that the sort of like Mongoche sort of move of like that offhand sword dagger strike after they trap the sword. I love it. There's so much kind of, I feel like, deep fencing in that sort of move. And I like a lot of fiction that has like sword play in it. And when there's a lot of that straightforward, like we're one sword at a time, and then someone pulls out that dagger as that second move, I'm always like, I like you. I like your style. You're my kind of scum. So I liked that one. That's actually, when I saw it, I was like, oh, I like that move. And I really like the kind of the sequence that they have to do, because it's very brutal, but it's very ballet too.
It's got steps. You see it coming.
It's funny because this is in some ways kind of the essence of martial arts movies, is that they're in many ways like dance movies. You know, there is that aspect of it. Just it's a movie with dance, just with violent, bloody, cut a guy up, beat a guy up sort of dance. But it's dance nonetheless. Watching it so effectively, even with clearly super trained swordsmen and from the Golden School, especially the two swordsmen who are basically figure out that the other students are being ambushed and lie in wait. And still, you know, they both succumb to it too. Although I did get a little annoyed by that by the end. I was like, at some point I was like, okay, you're watching them do this move. It's not too hard to figure out what their special trick is. And yet all of you seem to still fall for it each time. This is what Bruce Lee meant about like the sort of the dogma of form in martial arts, you know, and kind of the key to his idea of like Jeet Kune Do. It's like, you know, it's really formless. It's like the only form is the human body and how it moves, and which in this movie is perfect because his human body has been changed and altered and therefore gives him this advantage in the fighting free realm, even though it would seem to be a clear disadvantage, as it's shown at least early as he's first learning to adapt to his new ableness status, as it were.
Well, in this case, I'm going to give you the medal, because while my moment is, I think, a nice dramatic one for the hero.
Oh, for sure.
It's not so much a move as much as yours. And I think the way it's very nuts and bolts, you know, you see it coming. I think that move is the better one. So let's head into the finals. We've got the lantern strike versus the sword catching underhanded dagger combo. What's the move of the week?
From the technical point of view, I would go with the sword catch dagger move. But from the sort of think on your feet, it's hard for me to say, because I like the idea, you know, I like the impromptu fighting trope that comes out a lot in Kung Fu. The idea like, oh, I'm just going to pick this thing up and I've just made myself. Is that a stool? No, it's not. It's a weapon. We'll talk about stool fighting, I'm sure, at some point. in this series.
Yeah, Chair Fu.
Chair Fu. I love Chair Fu. I got to give it to the lantern one because, you know, ultimately, while I really love the technicality of the sword trap and the dagger strike move and the sort of like brutal ballet of it, it's not as satisfying as, you know, the lantern move. Because the lantern move, it, like you said, it's a quick move, but it's that sort of like, ah, it's the hero's move. And I like the heroes. So I would have to say for this week, I'd give it to the lantern move.
And I'll have to agree because, yeah, I want to give that first award. I want to give it to a hero.
Yeah.
So Sante wins it, not Long Arm Demon and his cronies.
Yes.
Finally, we get to recommendations. You know, there are a lot more Shaw Brothers films to see. I could easily draw up a top 20 for you that I've loved, but we'll try to keep it, keep our recommendations short and pithy. So here are our three each of our three recommendations for Shaw Brothers flicks worthy of your attention, dear listener. For me, I would recommend, I've talked, at length about Lau Kar Lung on this episode. So two of his films for sure, I would include Heroes of the East, which is like Shaolin versus Ninja is the bad title of it, which is another pure martial arts film, shows a lot of different techniques. It's funny. It's kind of a Taming of the Shrew movie, and there's absolutely no one dies in it. It's pretty amazing. And the other one is My Young Auntie, which stars Kara Hoy, who was the sometime wife of Lau Kar Lung. And it showcases not only female martial arts, which have their own styles, but also is a contrast between the modern Hong Kong and the more ancient Chinese traditions. It's quite funny as well. Then for Cheng Che, I can only recommend Five Deadly Venoms. I've mentioned it before. It was another trendsetter. After Five Venoms, there were a lot of Five This, Five That, Five Crippled Avengers, Five Elemental Ninjas, and Cheng Che was usually helming those films. And he made stars out of all of them. So those were my three recommendations. I think they're seminal Shaw Brothers films that anyone should see. What about you?
All right. Well, I'm going to recommend Master of the Flying Guillotine, just because for the simple fact that he's got a basket on a chain and it's a badass weapon.
It's crazy.
It's a crazy basket on a chain. For other ones, I'd have to pick the sequels to both of our movies where it would be my other picks because they're great setups. And I think definitely the idea of like, while there was a lot of one-armed swordsmen, there's clearly a one-armed swordsman trilogy. And the second one in particular is of the one-armed swordsman is supposed to be sort of like, they really kind of hit the stride. And then just, anything where there's more of that sweet, sweet Shaolin action is another one of it too. Because just the whole training sequence of 36 and to get more. And frankly, he never made it to the 35th chamber. So,
Well, Return is a pretty funky film as well. So Return to the 36th chamber. I love that film as well as and even Disciples of the 36th Chamber, which doesn't star Gordon Liu, is still a pretty fun film as well. So I vouch for all of these. Well, that's all the time we have, folks, but come back next time for more crazy kung fu action. Thanks for spending this time with me, Dr. G.
Oh, absolutely. I was so excited to do this. We, as we kind of talked about a little hinted at the top of the show, we've been brewing this idea for a while, so I'm very happy to see it come to fruition.
And since we do enjoy reading your comments, a reminder that the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. But you can also visit the Fire and Water Podcast Network, a Facebook page, or tag us on Twitter using the hashtag FWPodcasts. Find my other work at Siskoy's Blog of Geekery and the Fire and Water Network, and Dr. G's at Pulp to Pixels Podcasts. Until then, be water, my friends.